Happy hump day, people. It is episode 54 of the Brother Trucker Book Club podcast. I am Graham Bradley. Today we're talking again about books that have to do with boating, for better or worse, sometimes for sport, sometimes for your own survival. Ready and... Back in, I want to say 2016, maybe, Andrew Luck, superstar quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts and known nerd, started his own book club, not really with a podcast. I guess he does have a podcast. I listened to it a couple of times. It was all right, but a lot of his book recommendations are really cool. He plugged this one by Daniel James Brown called The Boys in the Boat. I want to say that there was a Netflix special about this, or a special that ended up on Netflix, but it's about the team that represented the U.S. in rowing in the 1936 Olympics, which were held in Germany, right as the, you know, the Führer was rising to power and so on and so forth. And for me, who knows, you know, nothing about the sport of rowing, especially Olympic rowing, in the 30s, this was amazingly accessible. I will say that I haven't read it since the first time I read it, which was in 2016. Was it 2016? Maybe it was 2015. It could have been. But the point is that the names of the different people that it focuses on, I keep wanting to say characters, but that feels wrong when it's a nonfiction. The names of the different Olympians that it focuses on are kind of all escaping me now, because it's about nine different people. And he, you know, he starts the narrative focusing on this guy and then this guy and then this guy, and, you know, kind of their upbringings and their youths, and then how they all ended up in college at the University of Washington, which is where, you know, they ended up joining the rowing team for various reasons, and then how they got on it and they started competing with Stanford and with other schools on the West Coast, and, you know, all about how they made their boats. They made their boats, you know, by hand, by, you know, with wood from local trees, kind of thing. Not for the hipster reasons that Seattleites might do it now, but for technical and practical reasons. You know, they even talk about the history of boat making and how eventually they stopped making them out of wood because they had, you know, higher tech, higher quality process materials, lacquered stuff, this, that, the other thing, fiberglass. But, you know, this is how analog it was just, you know, 80 years ago. And, you know, they had coaches that were big on making sure that they ate the right things, that they swore off, you know, alcohol and junk food and fried food and stuff. You know, even before the dietary sciences got to the level that they are now. And it was amazing how much of it has to do with synchronization and making sure that they're all working together, and how these, you know, these guys that were, you know, members of the A crew and the B crew, you know, the JV squad and the varsity squad could all work together extremely well when they were on JV. But as soon as they got bumped up to varsity, they struggled, and the coach would just beat it into them how much better at this they had to be. And these guys all came from very hard and tough backgrounds. You know, they were working their way through college as the Great Depression was in full swing. And some of these guys were kids that had been abandoned by their parents when they were, you know, in their mid-teens. We're talking like, you know, the dad is a widower and they've got some younger kids, and the dad meets some, you know, hot new chick who's 10 or 15 years younger than his last wife, and she can't handle the new family. So the dad says, "All right, kids, I love you, but I got to go," and bails on them when the oldest is 15 and just like leaves a house to them. Not that there's a big old, you know, legal precedent for all this, a whole bunch of paperwork like there would be today. And suddenly these kids got to grow up and take care of themselves and take care of each other and plan for the future, you know, and work a farm, you know, all that stuff. Just things that would, you know, crush me, and I'm a child of the 90s. Kids these days would freaking melt under all this pressure. But to not only survive that kind of life, but then thrive in it and then go on to do something as awesome as becoming not just like collegiate champions, but Olympic champions. These different college teams were competing with, you know, like I said, West Coast boat crews and even these elite Ivy League schools from the East Coast to represent the U.S. in the Olympics, and then, you know, go to the enemy's homeland. And this was, you know, shortly after World War One. This is only 15 years after the end of World War One. Well, maybe a little bit longer than that, but, you know, it's still in recent memory. Everybody had you know, not forgotten the whole World War One bit, but then World War Two happens, and shortly thereafter, and you know, people's tempers with Germany are running even higher. But 1936, they go into the belly of the beast, and they've got to row against one of the best teams of the world in hostile territory. It's as cinematic a narrative as a nonfiction has been that I have read. I would highly recommend it. Check out The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. Get an idea for who these people were and how hard they worked and the things that they survived, and just be impressed by the incredible accomplishment that they achieved and put forth, one that will stand forever. I highly recommend it. Another Andrew Luck Book Club selection that I read that has to do kind of tangentially with boating is the book Unbroken by Lauren Hillenbrand. It was made into a film of the same title. I want to say Angelina Jolie was a producer of it. There was some big deal about that. I haven't seen the movie yet, but as part of my episode prep, I went ahead and put the DVD on my to-watch list for the library, and I'm gonna check that out, see how it holds up to it. But it is the nonfiction account of a man named Louis Zamperini, an Italian. He wasn't an immigrant, but his family, you know, were descended from immigrants. And he was a track star in high school. He joined the army in World War II. He was stationed at Pearl Harbor. He wasn't there for the assault on Pearl Harbor, but he was one of the guys whose jobs was to you know, be a mechanic for airplanes and stuff like that. And they were out flying one of these airplanes, and you think airplane accident over the Pacific, and you imagine, oh, they must have been in a dogfight with the Japanese or something. They get into the statistics of it, but apparently the amount of planes that went down over the Pacific from the Army Air Corps was staggeringly high. I can't remember the percentage, but I remember it was over 50% of them went down due to mechanical failure. Keep in mind that in the 1940s, aeronautics, aviation, was a science that was, I mean, about 40 years old. And we had gone from the Wright brothers and their motorized gliders that could be, you know, heavier than air and self-propelling, to building B-29 bombers. And these planes were going down over the water because largely either the materials had been put together too fast, these planes had been assembled too hastily. There might have still been a lot about the engineering and the science that we just didn't know, and so a lot of these planes went down due to mechanical failure. Some of them even had what you might call a ghost in the machine, where they put this whole thing together exactly as well as they knew, exactly according to spec, and yet the plane would still fly weird or something, and they couldn't figure out why. Well, Zamperini and his crew were out flying one of these planes, a plane that required a crew of 10 or so. Think back to the 90s movie Memphis Belle, and if you haven't seen it, definitely go and see it. Star-studded cast, one that would just, you know, be way too expensive to reproduce now. Like, Billy Zane is in this movie, Sean Austin, John Lithgow, probably others that I can't remember off the top of my head. But these B-29 bombers had crews of like 8, 9, 10 people, between the pilot, the co-pilot, the engineer, the bombers, the various gunners, the medic, the comms officer, and all that. Well, this plane crashed. It went down in the ocean. Louis Zamperini and two of the other crew members were the only ones to survive. And all they had were two life rafts and a very small amount of food. Basically, all they had was like these little chocolate nuggets that were not meant to be tasty. They were produced by the Hershey's Company, but they weren't like candy. They were supposed to be, you know, high-density nutrition that didn't taste good, so that people wouldn't be tempted to eat it unless they had to. And that was enough to survive them for, like, a couple of days. Then the boat started drifting west. It drifted a couple of thousand miles to a little rocky cluster of islands called Japan. You might have heard of it. We were at war with them at the time. But it wasn't some peaceful cruise in a raft across the ocean that brought them to Japan. They dealt with sharks. They dealt with the weather. They dealt with being strafed by Japanese fighters who saw, you know, a yellow raft in the water. And like, these planes came down close enough to the point where Zamperini and his friends could like see the faces of the Japanese pilots. And they had to survive that. They had to figure out how to catch birds, catch fish, and, you know, eat them raw to survive. And you even talk about them kind of discovering God while they were on this floating voyage across the water. the promises that they made to him, that if, you know, hey, if we get out of this, I'll commit my life to you. Then they wash up on an island, they get caught, they end up in POW camps. That's no picnic. They're there for a really long time. Again, the technical details of what they had to do to survive will boggle your mind. The things that they did just to get salt that had iodine in it, which was, you know, necessary for their survival. The diseases that ran rampant through these camps, the personalities of the Japanese captors that they had to deal with. And then, oddly enough, surviving the liberation and the sudden excess of food that was dropped onto them by American reliefs, relief bombers. From what I understand, the movie Unbroken doesn't go into too much excessive detail about post-war life for Louis Zamperini. It's more about him, you know, surviving the voyage, surviving the POW camps, and then getting home. But a significant portion of the book dedicates itself to showing Zamperini's post-war life. And the narrative of that, let's say, hashtag Price of Discovery, I think is very, very moving, whether or not you're a Christian. Because, like I said, remember, he was making promises to God on that raft, and those promises do come home to roost, and the impact that it had on him and the rest of his life is very, very inspiring. You know, hopefully not just to the Christian mind. I myself am a Christian, so I would have a hard time like putting myself completely in the shoes of somebody who was reading it outside of that perspective. But definitely check out Unbroken. It's by Lauren Hillenbrand. Content warning, there's a couple of times when they quote people who were using military language, and by that I mean Vulgarian, as it were. So there's a couple of F-bombs in it. I don't remember too much beyond that, but check that one out. And that will do it for this episode. Check back in on Friday for Tales from the Road. Until then, drive safe. See you out there.